Hi and welcome to Call of the Wild, a podcast presented by A Wild Connection. I'm your host and producer, James Curry. On this podcast, we introduce you to some of the most influential voices in wildlife and conservation. Learn about the issues facing many of the Earth's species and meet authors, TV hosts, wildlife advocates, and scientists working on the front lines. We want to show you how people from all walks of life connect with wildlife and the outdoors. So prepare to be inspired, educated, and entertained. My guest this week is birding expert and author Richard Crosley. Richard is a lifelong birder and author of the esteemed Crosley ID Guides. His books have revolutionized the way we look at birds through groundbreaking photography and design. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you're all staying healthy. And without further ado, let's meet Richard Crosley. Richard, how are you doing, mate? How's it going?
I'm doing fantastic. But I have a question right off the bat, James. How come you put that posh voice on when you're on TV or doing podcasts, but when I'm beating you at cricket or something, you talk very differently?
Well, this is not a place for cuss words, Richard. This is a podcast and we've got to be a little bit proper for our audience here. So, and by the way, I'm interviewing you in this podcast. So tell us, Rich, how did you get involved in birding? How did it all start for you?
Well, I started when I was 7 years old. I'd grown up on a farm, so I'm sure that's why I love nature. But when I was seven, we lived in a forest and I started collecting birds' eggs, just as my dad had done and his dad had done. So it was almost a cultural thing. And I was really fortunate because when I was 10, I moved to a different area where my school teacher was a birder. And so he got me into birding. He took a group of us out each weekend and I sort of fell in love with it.
And so you moved across from the UK to the United States. How long ago?
Oh, that's a while ago. I was 21. I came here for the very first time and I kept coming back each summer, loved it. And I moved here for good in 91. I guess I was 27 at the time.
And tell me about that transition. What was that like for you, moving across from the birds from the UK to the birds from the USA? Big difference, right?
Oh, a huge difference. And it was actually the birds that were the big allure to come here. Cape May in particular. So you have these massive migrations. You know, so many more birds over here, the variety, great weather. And so I love the spectacle of visible migration. I actually love the town of Cape May as well. So I came for what the five Bs, the birds, the feathered type, the birds, the non-feathered type, they all have two legs, the books, meaning to make money to subsidize traveling around the world, the beach, and the booze. So the five Bs, and actually in the late 80s, lots of other birders followed followed what I was doing and for the five Bs.
Wow. Okay. So the five Bs, I got to get some of those five Bs in my life, which is a little bit difficult being a married man, huh? So Rich, tell us a little bit about your connection with nature. How do you connect with nature? Obviously, it's through birds, but tell us a little bit about the inspirations for getting outdoors.
You know, I've thought about it a lot. I'm not really sure what it is that really sort of sucked me in. You know, as you know, James, obviously because I'm a lot better at sport than you, but I was big into sport. At 14, I was asked to sign pro papers at football and cricket, and I turned them both down because of birding. So I often look back to then and say, what was the real draw? And I think it's lots of things. One thing is 24 hours a day, so you can do it all the time. You can, wherever you go, whether you're looking through a window like I am now, driving a car, or actually outside, wherever you are in the world, you can do it. And it is actually licensed to travel. You never master it, you know, so it's this voyage of discovery all the time. And the beauty of birds is just fantastic. And I really love not knowing. And so you never know what you're going to find, what's going to show up next. And hopefully we're moving the needle. You know, birding's really in its infancy. So I think there's so many aspects of it. And I've actually seen that more clearly in recent times, because if I've been doing it 40 odd years, I've seen how I've changed through the decades and really changed who I am. And there's different parts of it that appeal to me more now than they did in the past.
And so there's a difference, I believe, between bird watching and birding. Can you explain to our audience the difference between the two? Because the one's a little bit passive and the other one's a bit more active. Which do you partake in?
Well, I've always considered myself a birder, but so a birder is somebody who's really hardcore. It's almost an obsession. It's their, you know, the primary goal in life. A bird watcher is somebody who does it casually. So I'm definitely a birder. But what kind of birder I am is really up for debate right now. So it used to be about traveling and discovering unusual things. I would say in the last decade, it's been more about connecting with other people, and I guess you would call it giving back, because I've taken so much of it. It's shaped my life, it's shaped me, and I feel very, very fortunate.
Yeah, you know, it does. You know, I've been birding for a lot of my life too, and it's certainly provided me with endless inspiration and almost like a form of meditation when I've been out there watching birds. But I'm interested in your take on what is it in particular about birds that draws you to them? What is the allure of birds in particular as a creature?
Actually, I think it's the availability. It's they move so quick. There's loads of them. You see them all the time. They offer this great challenge. It's funny, I was thinking about that this morning. If there were 200 species of cats in North America, would I be looking at birds or big cats? And I'm not really sure. So I think what it is, it's just this connection with nature. And I think it's almost that birds are an excuse to do that. And I think it's the same, you know. So birds are my thing with binoculars, a scope, and now a camera. And so really they're just tools. If I'd been born in America, I'd have probably been a hunter. So it's just different tools that I use. But the one thing that all of them have in common is you go outside to and go back to actually being the animal that I think I am.
So why do you say you would have been a hunter if you were born in the US versus the UK?
Yeah, in England, birding is huge. Hunting is very small. So in England, birding is a young man's sport. So when I started in the 80s, you'd go and see a rare bird and there'd be 1,000, 2,000, I know I'm not supposed to say it, but men, mostly young men there, almost no women. Very much a sport, very competitive. And because it was lots of young men, they're always driving each other, you know. We want to be part of the club and we want to be at the leading edge of it. So always trying to improve, you would feed off one another. It spurred me to travel all around the world. You know, most of us are followers, or I say wannabes. And so I saw these other young guys, you know, at 18, 19, we're already traveling to Asia and birding for 3-4 months at a time. And so I wanted to be like them. And so at the age of 15, 16, I started hitchhiking. I hitchhiked over 100,000 miles chasing rare birds. And then, you know, by the time I was 21, I was already traveling around the world. So it's very exciting. It was a license to travel, and I loved that as well. Going to these, you know, incredible places out in the middle of nowhere and meeting the real people. And it was a fantastic education because you met the real people in these countries, and just fantastic people. People who, in real terms, were poor financially, but really they've lived incredibly rich lives.
Wow, 100,000 miles, huh? That, well, you must have seen some stuff on that trip.
Well, I don't know if I can tell you this, but actually, Deb, my wife, right? So she lived in the same house as me. Now, I remember the very second I saw her, but it took her 5 weeks to remember seeing me. And so it wasn't for my looks or anything like that, which I'm sure you can say, well, of course, Richard. But it was actually because I was never there. And so she thought it was exciting that this guy was hitchhiking, traveling all over the country. So the next thing I know, she actually asked me out, in part because she wanted to travel around with me. So whatever floats your boat, right?
So what was the craziest thing you saw on that journey, 100,000 miles? I mean, were there any instances where you didn't have a place to stay that night, or like some crazy instances that you remember?
Are you kidding me? Place to stay? Are you kidding me? So I did 100,000 miles, and So the news back then, because there was no cell phones, it was a grapevine. So you had to work yourself into the grapevine. You had to prove your worth. You just couldn't get the information. There was really no computers to speak of. And so you had to be on the grapevine. So you got a phone call. The phone calls usually came in the evening. So you would hitchhike through the night to be there for dawn. So most nights you usually take a sheet from a double bed. And so you would often sleep outside. A couple of times actually broke into rooms in the services, people's cars, you name it, I've slept there. So most of it I kept quiet from my mum in particular. But yeah, that was part of the thing. And you had to show your worth, right? You couldn't be staying in hotels. Oh my goodness. Real birders don't do that.
So it sounds like it's a proverbial case of wherever I lay my hat, that's my home. So Rich, moving on to your books and your guides. So I've looked at the Crossley ID guides and you've really revolutionized the way that we look at birds, the way that we study birds. And for the audience, the Crossley ID guides are amazing guides that allow you to identify birds, not only in the habitat in which they're found, but also in the different plumages and the male and the female versions and in flight and on the ground, etc. So you really get a perspective on what birds look like in the real world. And I'd encourage you to look at crossleybooks.com to look at Richard's amazing array of guides. But Richard, tell me how you revolutionized this, a little bit about the history of bird guides in North America and how it's now transitioned to your guide, which I believe is the gold standard when it comes to guides today.
Well, I always remember when I was a kid looking at books, and frankly, they weren't right, So I always saw a bird as a size and a shape, and they always lived in certain places, and they moved and behaved in accordance to where they lived and what they needed to do. And yet you look in a book, they're side on a white background, or what I call snow. It's not real. And so it's like I wanted to create a book that was for me, basically. And so we're very lucky, technology, right? So digital cameras, Photoshop. See, photos taken with medium or large lenses are actually a lie. They're not lifelike. They're not what you see. If you look out of that room, that window right here, James, what do you see? Everything in focus from near to far. So it makes sense to create that image. If you're going to practice anything, it's got to be lifelike if you're really going to maximize the potential. So basically all I did was create these lifelike images of near to far, enables you to put the habitats in, the behaviors in, and then of course practice makes perfect. So the more birds, the more information you put in there, the better it is. And the other thing is, if I go out, because I'm not making enough money from selling these books, right, and rob a bank, okay, do you think the cops are going to ask for a painting or a photo? They're, of course, going to ask for a photo because photos are more lifelike. And so, again, it's books of paintings, while they're good, they don't make sense. And interesting, what I found out is this. Painted books are better for experts. Less information is what experts want. Beginners want more information. It's the opposite of what you'd think. And so what do we do for beginners? We dumb it down, right? Give them little information. And what does that do? It just confuses the bejesus out of them, right? Because they say, how does this thing go from being bright one day? Does it go to bed and wake up all dull and grey the next day? So in showing, different birds in transition from this plumage to this, so you can see how it progresses, how they change in appearance from near to far. These are things that help beginners and intermediate birders. And of course, intermediate beginning birders, they don't understand the minutiae, but do they understand habitat? Do they understand behaviour? Of course they do. So what are the things that people don't put in books? The things that they could understand. I mean, it's just crazy when you actually think about it and look at it. And so it's been an interesting learning curve, not only on making the books, but also seeing the reaction of the audience. So we'll see how it goes moving forward, but I think people are very much warming up to it these days.
Give us a quick rundown of your selection of books. Tell us what you're working on now, what's in the future, and what you've accomplished thus far.
Yeah. The first book I co-authored with Michael and Kevin was The Shorebird Guide. So that was an old school book with just individual images. We laid it out very, very differently to other static books, I call them, where they're all 3x2. So we tried to make every image different to the last one to keep it interesting. And we started with a habitat, and then we start with juveniles as they progress through life. But while making that book, it's like, this is good, but it's wrong. And how do we put all of this information into one page rather than 6 or 7 pages? And so when Photoshop and digital photography came along, I had to become a photographer for the Shorebird Guide. And so I was sort of getting into photography, because I wasn't before, I was just a birder. So we were able to make these books. We started with the Eastern Guide. Then I think we did the Raptor Guide, Britain and Ireland. And the last one is the Waterfowl Guide. The Western Guide is going to come out next year. So I apologize to any of you folks in the West. I know I've been getting quite a lot of hate mail asking where it is, but it's nearly finished. And so we're moving forward with those, and then we have some ideas I can't tell you about, maybe the next podcast, about where we're going to go from here. And then we're just about to publish another book called Ornithotherapy, Changing the Heart, Mind and Soul. And this is a little different. This is not necessarily for birders. This is more for the general public to connect people to birds through mindfulness and also to have a look at themselves. It's going to have 52 challenges, which are lots of information, but then encouraging them to go out and look and learn. And then be a little introspective, look at yourselves as well, and how, as fellow animals, because both birds and we're all animals, right? How we actually have more in connection than what we often think. So we're doing that with Holly Merker and with my daughter, Sophie Crossley. So, you know, we've just done that because of COVID-19, and really because, you know, birding is healthy. We know now with chemicals, it actually releases different hormones that are very healthy when you go out and look at birds with nature. So people need to be doing it for their physical health and their mental health. So we think it's really, really important. America's not done a good job of it, way behind other countries in the world. But it is time to catch up, because America has so much more to offer than most other countries in the world.
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept, ornithotherapy, and speaks to connecting people with nature through birds, obviously. Now, is that something that you would suggest that you have some prior knowledge of birds to participate in, or is it something that anybody with a general sort of interest in nature can get involved in?
No, absolutely not. In many ways, it helps if you start with a clean slate. You know, just look at what you see and ask yourself, what are you seeing? See, most people come into something with preconceived ideas. It's actually better to help somebody, teach or inspire somebody when they know nothing, because you can help shape them to do it the right way. And size, shape, behavior, and its connections with the habitat of where and how they live are really the basis for all good birders. Sadly, in this country, everybody's focused on color. And as I think you've heard me say, colour in birding is the root of all evil. That's why most birds are misidentified, and that's why a lot of birders never become good, because that's where the focus is. And, you know, birding is not about putting names on birds and doing lists. I know people like that, but at the end of the day, if you're trying to put a name on everything all the time, birding's really difficult. Most of the time you can't do it. Even I can't do it a lot of the time. Right? But if you emphasize that and you can't put a name on it, you feel like a failure. Well, if that's the case, after a while, you just stop doing it, right? So it's not about names. After all, when we look at people, we often recognize people. Oh, that's the really tall guy. He's crazy. He does this, he does that, and he lives over there.
That'll be me.
That's you. But often we don't know people's names, right? But we still know the people. So it's the same thing with the birds. Learn their personality, what they do, how they do it. Don't worry about the name. The name comes. And it's much more fun. It's all about the discovery. it's not about the answer, you know, it's the journey to get there that's the fun.
So we're sitting in a crazy time right now. We are all stuck in our houses, most of us, with lockdowns around, not just in the States, but around the world. And you alluded a little bit to birding as a suitable pastime for this crazy time that we're in of COVID-19. So speak a little bit to why birding is positioned as a healthy sort of outdoor activity during this time, and especially with social distancing, how it works to be a birder.
Well, it doesn't even have to be outdoors. It can be indoors. So I spend so much of my time looking through the windows. There's no way my computer desk is not next to a window, and there's no way I'm not going to set it up outside to attract birds. And so same thing today. You can put you advertise there's your hummingbird feeders and things that you could stick on the window by your kitchen window and wash your dishes up in some style, right? So it's everywhere, and that's the beauty of it. If you don't have a garden, there's always birds flying over, and there's always a park down the road. And I love going back to the same places, because the more you watch your garden at the local park, the more you realize how much is happening, how it changes, you know, and watching that change is fascinating. And so, you know, with COVID-19, you know, I think people want and need something to connect to. A lot of people have not looked at wildlife and really thought about it too much. I think it's almost intimidating, because they feel like they have to know the answer, i.e. put a name on it, and that is so, so wrong. None of the best birders look at birding like that. It's all about what they don't know. They love not knowing. It's that discovery that makes them the best, right? Because they're never good. Once they think they're good, they stop learning. And so if you don't know much, that's exciting, right? So it's just that voyage. Embrace the voyage. Don't worry about the name. And ultimately, after a while, once you start doing it for a while, the biggest problem you have, it's contagious. It's a drug. You can't do without it. And so right now, if I'm stuck inside, and I've talked to lots of people about this, you've got to get outside. And the second you get outside, if you're having a bad day, 5-10 minutes outside, it clears your mind. And actually, science is now showing, not only did it clear your mind, it resets your brain. And so we've actually been setting nonotherapy up for businesses as well. We just started doing it for that, and then COVID-19 came along. So we've sort of done a little about switch, you know. But again, so if you're at work and you're on your computer, you've been in meetings and you've had enough of it, right? You need to reset your brain. So to go outside for 5-10 minutes, you know, you come back in, you refresh, you start again. So it's very productive for people. And so there's so many different aspects to onotherapy. We could have a few podcasts on that one, James.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's been a sort of a new phrase or a new term that has been floating around. I think it was Richard Louvre maybe who initially brought it to light, but nature deficit disorder. Yeah. And how, you know, with the increase in technology, I watch my own kids and the amount of time they spend on their screens, mm-hmm, versus getting outdoors. I think this is going to certainly be the next major pandemic to affect the human race, is the fact that we are not connecting with nature anymore. So I must commend you for looking at ways to get people connected with nature again. And I think ornotherapy sounds like a really great option for people that want to, number one, learn a little bit more about birds, but also learn a little bit more about themselves by connecting with nature. So, Rich, I've got a question for you that's bugged me for a long time. When I, you know, we've both been birders for a long time, but, you know, we both fall into the typical stereotypical birder, a white male, elderly white male.
Excuse me, both of us
getting there.
Fit older white male, okay.
Way more older than me. But we do fit into that kind of stereotype. And I'm wondering, are you seeing a shift in moving away from this white male oriented pastime to something that's more inclusive, with minorities getting involved, and how do we get minorities and women and kids involved more in birding?
That's a tough one. And, you know, obviously it's with all the riots going on right now, it's atrocious. And we're going to get into some... It's your first podcast, so we'll get into some hot water here. Okay, first of all, with colour, I hate colour. Okay, so I'm not white. There's no part of me is white. And I've never seen a black person in my life. I don't mean that to be disrespectful, but we're all shades of brown. We're all the same. And so I actually hate that terminology. And in the case of Burden, I think it's a very socioeconomic thing. So if you're in a poor inner city, it's just not a priority in your life. There's few places to go. And to be honest, in inner cities, you've got to be a tough dog. And I don't think the image of Burden in America is tough, you know. And so some things like that, I really feel we have to change. As you know, James, over the last 15 years, I've spent massive amounts of time trying to get more kids into Burden. We've done lots of things, some of them together, right? Race for Birds, Pledge to Fledge. And 15 years ago, there were no young birders. Today, there are lots. So that is the most exciting thing that's happened in America in the last decade or so. And I think they will become the game changers. Some of them are from inner cities. Some of those kids are darker brown, or whatever the terminology is. I just don't like the terminology we're using now. And so I think we actually have to grow it from the youth, not from city centres or anything like that. We have to make it more fashionable. We have to have much better leaders who are young and dynamic, who appeal to a broad cross-section of people. You know, when Steve Irwin died, that was probably the biggest tragedy for American conservation, because he was having a massive impact on young people. You know, Sophie, my oldest daughter, cried her eyes out that day when she heard about it, and she wanted to be a marine biologist because of him. And so we need some more Steve Irwins, and then we can really make this thing, you know, change. And the momentum is already there. There's not lots of things we can do, but the momentum is there with the youth. They're obviously very tech savvy, you know, and I do think technology, obviously cameras is already making a great strides, right? You look at the photography in your upcoming series. I mean, it's, I know nobody else has seen it. I have. It is mind-blowing. And that is only, again, just going to bring people closer to nature. And again, the TV, as you're doing, it's going to help people connect better. TV in America has been really poor about connecting people with their backyards and local places and the things that they already know something about. So, James, no pressure, mate, but it's on you.
Yeah, absolutely. So just recently there was that controversial incident in Central Park. I'm sure you heard about it. We had that unfortunate incident where a guy was birding in Central Park, a black guy, and he was basically, this woman basically called the cops on him for birding in Central Park because she was scared. So what's your message to minority black birders out there? I know you don't like the term color at all, but it is what it is, and this has been brought out in the media. What's your message out there to minorities and people of color who might not feel comfortable going out with a pair of binoculars and a spotting scope out there to go and watch birds in, let's say, an urban environment like Central Park?
I'm not qualified to answer that. All I would do is encourage them to keep doing it. And, you know, no, none of us want to be intimidated by other people. You know, there's a lot of people, particularly that lady there. Well, lady's the wrong term, that woman. You know, that was disgraceful. But I hopefully, you know, everybody needs to, women, different colours, people with weird accents like you, you know, we have to keep going, right? And we all face different adversities, but some people more than others. So, you know, what was good about that, there was massive condemnation, and hopefully, you know, some people felt that they were loved and supported, as is the case with the riots right now. So there's support not only in America, but, you know, there's support all over the world. So there are actually protests in places like England in support of, what's going on over here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to move on to a little bit of a lighter subject. Is there one moment in your birding career that you can, a quick story that you can tell us that was absolutely hilarious? Maybe it's looking for a particular species and trying to get somebody to see a particular rare bird and anything that went on around that. Is there one particular sort of moment in your life that you can think of that kind of blew your mind and was pretty funny?
No, not really funny. The ones I talk about, I can't put onto podcasts. You know,
they're X-rated.
They're X-rated, you know. And some of the places I've slept and things I've done, you know. But, I mean, I could fill a few books up. I will say that. I've met some of the most incredible people, incredible stories while hitchhiking. And then some of the birders are just remarkable. As you know, the English birding scene, it still is, but back in the 80s, 90s, was just amazing. And, you know, when you're in it, you don't really understand how exciting and unique it was. I don't think there'll ever be an era like that. And even today, if you look at a lot of the top birders in the world, a lot of the top conservationists all over the world, they actually come from that English birding scene. So even, you know, American Bird Conservancy, Mike Parr is from that scene. You know, Steve Howell does a lot of the most innovative books from that scene. So I was very fortunate to be from that scene.
And there's a lot of perils facing really adventurous birders, those that are going out to, you know, cross oceans and go to remote parts of the world to go and look at birds. I mean, you only need to look at Phoebe Schlettinger and what she went through when she went out and tried to see as many birds as she could in her lifetime and met a rather grisly end in Madagascar. It's not something for the faint-hearted birding if you're a serious birder, is it? I mean, tell us about some of the incidents you know, for example. I know that there was a British birder, I think, and photographer that went to go look for a particular species in India. And
well, David Hunt was a tour guide. He was actually leading a tour at Corbett National Park and heard a brown wood owl. And against advice from the guide, the local Indian guide and his fellow British guide, he was told not to do it, and he did. And well, he didn't make it back, right? So he saw a couple of tiger cubs, and mother tiger saw him, and that was that. I actually know 13 guys who died birding. And so on January the 3rd, 1986, I was up in the Himalayas with a couple of pals. And we were looking for pheasants, particularly Himalayan pheasant, a monal pheasant, this massive pheasant that's iridescent, purples, blues and different things. And so we'd met a couple of Swiss lasses and a New Zealand guy. And I was with my two pals. So the six of us set off. And my two pals and the two Swiss lasses came to the census pretty quickly and decided it was too steep. And me and the New Zealand guy went on, and we went on, and we went on. And we probably went 8-10 miles or something up this mountain. And we had six Himalayan pheasants fly past us, incredible colours, just in sunny day, magnificent. And in the background were six of the world's 10 highest mountains. And, you know, I mean, that's it. There's nowhere to go from that. Your life will never see anything like that again, you know. And so, you know, the problem was there was this, you know, a little cliff face round, not too far off, and some poor, fantastic looking habitat. So the New Zealand guy said, sod that, I'm off back, you know. But I was 21 or 2 and, you know, not real smart, you know, back then. I'm invincible, of course, you know, as you are when you just turned 22, I would have been. And in any case, the cliff face was a lot steeper than what I thought. And I ended up getting stuck. I said my last rites, prayer, screamed for help, kept my coat round my waist because I wasn't thinking rationally, and jumped into this ravine of suspended ice. And very luckily, I'd been in India for a couple of months, so I weighed a lot less than what I weigh now. And it supported my weight, and I scrambled, you know, back to firm ground. And, you know, so I was shaking like a leaf, and the only thing that was spoiling the day was this smoke in the distance. Well, my pals, when they're going back down, they decided, one went to the bathroom, decided to burn their toilet paper.
Oh, wow.
Set the mountainside on fire. I mean, for men, 10 miles or something it was, there was a line of fire. So they, ironically, they thought they'd made me into Toasted Crossley, and, you know, it's a miracle I'm not suspended in ice somewhere to this day. So, yeah, knew lots of guys that died, and in hindsight, we did some crazy things. I mean, I'm lucky to be here, but that's what you do, because we push the needle, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I know I've had some close calls myself, looking for birds.
What was your closest call, then?
That's another whole story. But I had a case where I came across lions while birding, and was charged repeatedly by a lioness and a male lion later, which was pretty frightening. All while trying to find wattled cranes for a client of mine when I was a bird guide back then. So
I think you're lucky, you see. You're so skinny, they probably had a good look at you, and when they got up close, said you're not worth eating.
Right, exactly. So Richard, tell me about like seabirds. You might know this, we've just come back from Riviera Nayarit, Mexico, where we've been filming blue-footed boobies, for example. And you know, seabirds are, for most birders, something they want to steer away from, because there's so many different plumage varieties of gulls and different ages, and they're very difficult to tell apart. But some people have an absolute fascination for seabirds, and there are dedicated pelagic birding trips that birders will go on to particularly find seabirds. We've done this incredible episode, I believe, that was an amazing experience for me to go down to Isla Isabel in Riviera Nayarit in Mexico and look for blue-footed boobies and sooty terns and magnificent frigate birds. And it was just absolutely fantastic. But what is it about seabirds that get certain birders going?
I don't know. I'm one of those birders, really. So I just came back off the Princess Cruise, right? Coral Princess, the one that got locked up in Fort Lauderdale with all the sick people. I was on the cruise before. Funnily enough, some of our guys, because there's a few birders, got the flu, funnily enough. But, yeah, so...
Got the flu,
yeah. So, you know, we're questioning what type of flu it was.
Is that what we're calling it these days?
But, yeah, so we had 3 weeks of just looking at seabirds. That was what the cruise was for. Just loved it. And I think there's something that they're so hard to see. So it is this hunter mentality. The rarer it is and the harder it is to see, it's that challenge, you know, it's unusual. We like the unusual. I'm not sure why, but there's something about it that fascinates us. And they're sort of wild, right? You know, these things travel all over the world. They sleep on the wing. They come ashore at night to remote islands. There's just something fascinating about them. And also we know very, very little about them, because they do live these secretive lives, you know. So I think we love the unknown. Certainly the hardcore of us, we love the unknown. And that is really more unknown with seabirds than probably any other group of birds.
And so have you been down to Mexico? Have you birded in Mexico at all?
I have birded in Mexico a few times. I love it. Love it. So, you know, one of the places, Veracruz, is the biggest migration spectacle in the world. Just mind-blowing. But I've traveled quite a bit down there, not too far from where you are. Been to Puerto Vallarta a couple of times, which I really like. I love the west coast of Mexico, the Yucatan. Yeah, fantastic.
Awesome.
Great people.
Yeah, it is great. And I think that's the amazing thing about birds, is it's for me, when I'm traveling, it's a vehicle through which I get to experience so much else, like other species of wildlife, amazing scenery, fascinating cultures, delicious foods. I mean, birds are the vehicle that take us to all these incredible places, right?
Absolutely. Yep. So many stories, you know, that people say you can't live off memories. I'm not so sure about that. I don't know if you can live off them, but they certainly make you feel good about yourself. And I encourage my kids to travel. you know, Sophie, she's on an island, a coronavirus-free small island off Thailand right now.
Wow.
The great thing is today I can talk to her every day, you know, and it sounds like she's next door for free. It's ridiculous, really. But yeah, so she's traveling all over the world. I hope she's like me. She was going to travel for a year, but it's already becoming 2 years. Mine became 6 or 7 years before I settled down. But it was the best. I have a degree in environmental sciences, but I didn't learn a whole lot. But by gum, traveling, it really taught me about life, what's important, values, and it really taught me what the world is truly like and what people are truly like. And that is not something you get on the internet or the TV or on the radio. And so, you know, actually backpacking when you travel is the way to go.
So a lot of our audience might be listening to this and they might have a connection with nature in some way, but perhaps it's not birds. If you had to give any advice to somebody that wants to get into birding, what pieces of advice would you give those people? What pieces of little pearls of wisdom do you have to offer?
Look.
Look.
Just look and ask.
Oh, look.
Look. Oh, come on.
Look. You got this Yorkshire accent. Is it look or luck?
There's only one person who speaks English here. So just look and ask yourself, what's it doing? Why is it doing? It's just actually, that's the biggest thing. And it's one thing that most people don't actually do. They don't look closely and question. They just try to fix and get an answer and count it. It's all the discovery. It's working out its behavior, why it's doing it. That's the fun in it. So you don't need to know a damn thing. Birds are just like us. So that really their lives, really like ours, and coronavirus has shown us, what's it come down to? 2/3 things. Water, food, and breeding, sex, continuation of the species. And so if you think of birds in those terms, it helps you work everything out. You know, why it's doing it, why it molts, why its colours are the way they are. It's either, you know, to survive for camouflage, or it's to get lucky to breed, to continue the species. So if you think of birds in those terms, it becomes much more fun. And then you look at the variation in them and work it out. And so my dad is fascinated with house sparrows. So he watches them because they breed, you know, in a building just next door. And he just spends hours watching them flying in and out. And, you know, the males do it more than the females. And they're always carrying this. And they do build it for so long. And so I would say, be a voyeur of wildlife. Just if you're a voyeur of people, yeah, it's better to be a voyeur of other wildlife. Other wildlife is far more interesting than people.
Sounds pretty kinky, Richard, being voyeurs and everything, but we'll go with that for now. Besides that, any other sort of resources for anybody that wants to get into birds? I'm presuming that no matter where you live, there's a local bird club or an Audubon society that people can get in touch with. Possibly they can get hold of your guide. Where's your guide available? Just some resources and tips for the audience out there.
Well, if you Google the Crossley ID guides, we come up everywhere, obviously Amazon. But also the website, actually the waterfowl guide, we just self-published. That's as much for hunters as it is for birders. So we're trying to bring groups together. Because like I was saying beforehand, really, we just use different tools. At the end of the day, we're just the same thing. And groups like Ducks Unlimited do fantastic things for wetlands conservation. And they create the best habitats for birds. And so, you know, being connected is important. So, yeah, anything, I'll put my name in online, you can find me. Go to the website, crossleybooks.com. And also we have the Crossley ID Boot Camp, which talks about some of the things, trips we do. And we have ornithotherapy.com, again, which if you're a very casual or a beginning birder or thinking of getting into birder, that's probably the way to go. Go to ornithotherapy.com. And we have a Facebook group called Ornithotherapy. Surprise, surprise. We only started that weeks ago and we've already got, I think it's pushing 2,500 members on that. And we have getting, and this is really mostly Holly Merker who's doing this. The comments she gets from people who were not into birds at all, it's pretty interesting, and how it's got people to think about themselves and reevaluate their connections with the outdoors, and again the therapeutic aspects of it. So any of those things.
Awesome, Richard. Well, it's been fascinating learning about your exploits and your endeavors and what you're up to. So thank you so much for joining us today. I can't wait to beat you at cricket again soon.
Good luck.
You know, for those of you listening, Richard has two residences. He has a house up in Cape May, New Jersey, but he also bought a house here in Florida to be closer to me so that he could beat me at cricket or try to beat me, but he's hasn't been having much success lately. But thank you so much for joining us, Richard. We really appreciate it. And remember, tune in to awildconnection.com. Follow us on YouTube, youtube.com/awildconnection, on Facebook, facebook.com/awildconnection, and on Instagram. And we look forward to seeing you again next week. Thanks so much, Rich.